Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hey guys, this is Rick. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes. Hi, Rick.
Cheryl here.
And this is Janet.
Hey, Cheryl.
And Janet.
Hey, Janet. And I got one more thing to do here.
Okay.
Sorry, when I come sliding in here from a session, I've got to get everything lined up.
That's okay. I'm just glad you're here.
Right.
Hello?
Getting closer.
Which one's the table?
Hey, Rick. It's Aaron. I'm here.
Thanks, Aaron. Glad you're here. Oh, my word. I am totally live. I can't believe it.
And, Rick, there's another question that's shown up whenever you get to the end of the questions I sent. Yeah.
Okie dokie. And we probably, for next week, Aaron, we need to cancel the Q&A call just because we've got I'll be at Smart Marriages.
Okay.
So I think, in fact, I'm speaking at this time when we're supposed to be having the call. So, okay.
We can just put you on through to Talk Shoe Live, Rick.
Well, I guess they could. I'm not sure what how good the telephone reception is going to be.
Oh, that's true. Okay, we'll cancel it then.
Okay, but go ahead and email me the other question too, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so I love this. This is my favorite time of the week. Let's see. It's a great question. Did your wife ever lock you out or ask you to leave, practice tough love? And if so, how long was it before you contacted her? How did that work? I know I'm supposed to be focusing on me, but 17 days with absolutely no contact from him after I changed the locks is incredible. He's missed things he can never get back, our 22nd anniversary, Father's Day, my 15-year-old son got his driving permit. I took him to his last drop-off at summer camp. Now our golden retriever, 12-year-old, has a spinal injury, and the vet wants to put her down. I feel a lot like Job. I can't call him, can't call Doug. He causes me too much pain to hear the lack of feeling for me in his voice. He told our friend from church that I made my choice. Time will tell if it's the right choice to stay in adultery. I don't know how long it'll be before I talk to him, but I can't call. If he cared at all, he wouldn't be 70 days out without even one single peep. How does he think the bills are going to get paid and the kids taken care of, or the animals even? He just put his whole life in a box on a shelf and went to play house with another woman and her child. So unfair. I don't want to call him. I don't feel being led to divorce. This is so hard. I just want to see God's hand in this mess and what he's doing with Doug. At 51, I've given him 24 years of my life, and I feel old and haggard, yet he wouldn't even give me 72 hours in EMS. Where is God in all of that? You know, the interesting thing, that last question, where is God in all of that, personally, you know, I can see the potential of where my faith plays into all of that in huge ways. My challenge in life is always not to let circumstances define God, but rather to let God define the circumstances. And if I can look at what's happening with Doug and say, well, you know, God must be doing something. He's got to be working. God's doing something. He's up to something at this point because all of this stuff is suddenly changing. If I let God define it, that's one thing. On the other hand, if I go, how could a loving God allow this to happen? Then I'm letting the circumstance define God. You know, in the long run, the only way Doug will find what's important to him will not be through success or his trying harder. It'll actually be through his failure, because I think most people learn through their failure, not through their success. But in reality, you know, what he's doing is just, you know, just so incredibly cruel and hurtful to you and to your kids and to your dog. And I mean, he's just 100% self-centered. And Dallas Willard, in his book, Renovation of the Heart, says that radical evil is nothing more than self-centeredness. Because it becomes completely loveless. And so when someone becomes totally self-seeking and they don't care about other people, they destroy everyone else that's ultimately connected to them. And I find that to be unconscionable, but also just sad. It's just tragic. For you, while I know that God doesn't cause the pain, I do firmly believe that we walk through the pain, and he's with us in the pain, and as long as I can see him, at least maybe that pain can make a little bit of sense to me. And, you know, what some of the things I've learned is I've kind of gone through pain. I guess, I don't know if this helps any, but I'll read a few of my lessons. I've been writing down my lessons that I'm learning from pain and from people betraying me. I've learned that God doesn't cause it, but he does cause all things to work together for good. I'm kind of finding it really interesting because I really do believe God doesn't cause it. Man causes it. But we seem to keep accusing God and trusting man, which I don't always get. I kind of learned that the events in my life really are the perfect events to take me deeper. I kind of believe that, in fact, I know what I've seen through this is that God's responsible for maintaining my relationship with him. It's not the other way around, and that even when I'm struggling and going through these things, that he's still maintaining it. I can see that Satan is a created and permitted being, that he's not equal to God, and I don't have to worry about the devil. I can also see that whatever gets my attention, one of the things I've learned, whatever gets my attention gets me. Therefore, I can never be free from the thing that ultimately captures my attention. That I've learned I really wasn't supposed to be focused on anything but him, not my mate, not my sin. That most things in life, I'm only able to learn in failure, that I'll never be able to learn them in success. I've also kind of figured out as I've gone through this that God's concern for me has never been that I not screw up. I can see that, you know, from my theology, the branch is held to the vine by the gardener first dipping his hand into the dung, mixing it up, packing around the branch so that it stays in there, and that ultimately God's in the midst of all the dung that's around me, that somewhere he's in there still holding me in place, that all of these things, they come to me not to drive Christ out, but for me to drive him deeper in, that the behaviors, like Doug's behaviors, you know, they don't define me. That there's a difference between what I have to do and what only God can do, because I can't do it. And the one thing he can't do for me ultimately is rest. I have to do the resting while he does all the work. that the secret to growing in my faith is to always put myself in situations, or to be put in situations, where if he doesn't show up, I'm sunk. That I must first kind of walk in the flesh and come to the end of me before I learn anything in the spirit. That I really do need safe people to talk to. That ultimately, I have to be offended till I can't be offended anymore. That conflicts are really normal, and why we think they're not normal, I don't know. That I can see that God doesn't want me to be a copy of somebody else. I'm learning it. My children are going to embarrass me, and that ultimately that's going to be a part of our mutual growth. Relationships are really about woundings and withdrawals, and it's my responsibility to keep the wounds clean and to make deposits. That all of my personal growth, you know, every revelation I've had, it doesn't come through my perfection, but rather through his perfect plan. That's kind of learning for me in my faith, that you never know that Christ is all you need until he's actually all you got. That he has a funny way of putting me in situations where he's all I have. And there's a quote I was listening to by Madame Guyon, a French aristocrat back, I believe, in the 1700s, that I thought was really good as she was leading kind of a revival in France. And she said that in order to maintain your sanity through these things, that you really had to begin to change your attitude when people do things to you like what Doug is doing. And this was her advice. And she wrote this from prison. She was martyred just because of her faith. And she wrote, if you're to branch out beyond just a time of prayer each day, other parts of your life, even your own viewpoint of life, will have to be altered. This new attitude must come for a very special reason, so that you can go deeper, still deeper into another level with your Lord. Remember, she's writing this from prison. To do this, you must first have a fresh attitude toward yourself as well as the Lord. It's an attitude that must go much deeper than any you've known previously. To do this, I must introduce you to a new word. That word is abandonment. To penetrate deeper into the experience of Jesus, it's required that you begin to abandon your whole existence, giving it up to God. So let's take the daily occurrences of life as an illustration. You must first utterly believe, and I think this is a hard thing, but I believe we can do this in times of, you know, abandonment like what you're experiencing. You must first believe that the circumstances of your life, that is every minute of your life, as well as the whole course of your life, anything, yes, anything that happens, have all come to you by his will and by his permission. You must utterly believe that everything that has happened to you is from and is exactly what you need. Such a look of faith toward your Lord will make you content in everything. Once you believe this, you'll then begin to take everything that comes into your life as being from the hand of God and not from the hand of man. And I guess abandonment to me is to say that I'm a living sacrifice, and I really do see that what I'm going through, I need to believe it has purpose and it has meaning. As much, and I can't, you know, I don't think that that takes away the pain, the incredible pain of what somebody like Doug is doing and the incredible day. It changes none of that. But ultimately, as I grieve, when I come to the place where that loss can be transformed and I can begin to see and believe with all my heart that God's using it to work something out in me, if I can just know it has some sort of meaning or purpose, that there's still a life, that you know, God is still doing things, then that's where I have to start. Because I'm sorry, I'm rambling here, but you know, my experience in walking with God is I'd rather be tempted and ask Jesus to come and be my victory than ultimately to never be tempted, because it's the temptations and the failures and the hard times I've gone through that have actually brought me the most life. I'd rather have worry and ask Jesus to be my peace and kind of move back into that relationship with God than not to have peace. I'd rather have pain and ask Jesus to be my comfort than to avoid pain. You know, I want to be able somehow to begin to participate with God, because in how I look at it, in the long run, what I will leave this life with isn't a good marriage. You know, the only thing I can leave this life with is the revelation of Christ. And I really want to just become a person of love. And if this is one of those circumstances that God can use, to help you become a woman of love, to learn more of him, then that can be a rich treasure. Again, it doesn't take away the pain. And you still, it's like getting drugged through a knothole butt first. You still got to go through the pain. But I hope you can find a way of looking at it and grieving it and embracing it and walking through it where, you know, you're able to be prepared for the next thing. So I don't know if that helps any. I guess I just call it, say, you know, my circumstances really aren't there to drive Christ out of me, but they actually, I think, tend to release, you know, God within me or Christ within me. And I really don't hate the world anymore. And I don't hate my flesh, and I don't hate my circumstances. I don't even hate people. I know that God's working all of that to bring me to that place of weakness and emptiness, where I really will invite him to come and be there for me and to do what I can't do and to be what I can't be. And I know that's a really long answer to maybe a question, but the fact that he hasn't contacted you for 17 days does not surprise me. You know, I think that he's made his decision, and there's really not anything else. He's not going to come knocking on the door. He probably won't knock on the door, if he knocks on the door, for a very, very long time. And all you can do is pray for him and not allow bitterness to eat you up. So hope that helps a little. At least maybe in way of encouragement. Next entry. Now, we're not doing good on the call here. Looks like divorce for now. Yeah, that would be it. My wife came in at 1:30 for the fifth night in a row. When I reminded her she'd promised not to do that, she began accusing me of all kinds of things. I had an affair in the past. Never happened. She never loved me. I was at fault for everything. I was never there for her and the kids. She completely rewrites all of our history to justify her affair. I asked her what she wanted. She said she wanted out. I told her nobody's keeping her there. She was free to do as she pleased and started discussing splitting the assets and child custody. I don't think she was expecting me to be prepared, but I've been thinking of asking her to move out for a couple of weeks. I have two questions. Have you seen many instances of the hurt spouse taking the offensive, making the unfaithful spouse take another look? I'm not holding out any hope, but God works in strange ways, and I continue to pray. Second, how do you get the only woman you've ever really loved out of your heart? Well, to the first question, I don't know what you mean by, have you seen many instances of the hurt spouse taking the offensive, making the unfaithful spouse take another look?
I think that's tough love, Rick, that he's talking about.
Yeah. Actually, Rick, I'm right here.
Okay, good. And I would certainly say, yes, I have seen that.
Yeah. I guess what I meant when I said that, Rick, was have you seen many instances of forcing the unfaithful spouse to make a decision, having them take another look. Because that's what I'm doing. I'm telling her to get off the pot, basically.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Highly, highly recommend that. And because ultimately, they need to be able to know that.
I'll be right.
I mean, yes. But the second one is really, the second question, how do you get the only woman you've ever really loved out of your heart? I think she'll probably do that for you. If she keeps abusing you the way she's abusing you, pretty soon she'll drive you out of her heart. Maybe God will allow her just to create enough pain in you that you're going, oh, good riddance, holy smoke, I can't believe, who are you?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm kind of at that point, but I can't drive her out right now. But I'm at the point of you know, I'm done, I've had enough.
Yeah, I do think that God brings us to the place where we can be done. And, you know, I certainly think, again, in that type of situation where someone, and I want to be careful because, like I said last time, you can't evaluate all situations by the same piece.
Right.
I mean, the rules don't always apply across the board, but where someone's continually, blatantly coming in, like at 1:30 in the morning, and you know, this is the thing she's doing. There's nothing wrong with setting that boundary and just saying, that's it. I mean, and the other thing is that one of the ways I think you also get her out of your heart, it's very much a way of a focus of pursuit and, or a pursuit of focus. I may have said that the wrong way, but if you'll fix your heart onto something else and stay focused on that, I think ultimately other things will slowly begin to fill your heart. I mean, to me, the way I dealt with loss was spiritually. I mean, that's what worked for me.
Right.
I just wanted to just learn to make my only focus knowing Jesus. I mean, that was my deal. And eventually that began to heal my heart and something else began to fill me. I mean, I began to find new life. So that's the only other thing I know to do, other than I think she'll probably drive herself out of your heart if she keeps this up.
Right. Well, there was a crash. You know, once I took the offensive, I went ahead and the next night I called her and told her, okay, I've started filling out the divorce papers. Now we need to sit down and figure out how we want to divide things. And when I called her, I said, you got a few minutes to talk? She said, yes. But suddenly when I said that, she had customers. I said, okay, I'm home. Call me when you're done. And, of course, she never called back. And then last night she called me to tell me where she was at. So, you know, I'm seeing very slight cracks in the armor right now. I don't think she expected that I was going to take this tact.
Oh, I'm sure she's probably a little surprised, but if she's rewritten history, she probably doesn't have a realistic view of who you are. I mean, she's also rewritten you and sees you as, either weak or crazy or, you know, who knows how she sees you.
Yeah, I mean, she's accused me of having an affair in the past, which has never happened. You know, I've been faithful for 15 years. You know, she's accused me of abuse, and that's never happened. You know, it's just all kinds of weird things that she's completely rewritten in history.
Yeah. It's been amazing the way people push away guilt. Matt is always, not always, but most frequently, by being defensive and blaming another person. But the other piece that's really important to remember is that anytime someone is being defensive, We're only defensive over our point of shame. So to me, it's just an indication of her shame. I mean, that's why this is happening.
Right. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Rick.
Well, I wish, you know, I wish her heart would soften. I really do.
Continue to pray for it.
That I can do.
That's kind of where I was too, Rick. I drew the only boundary I've ever drawn and got exactly what I suspected I would get, which was he just walked.
Janet, are you on the call?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Okay. Your situation is so different. I'm thinking that, and I don't know how you would feel about this, Leslie and I were actually discussing your situation.
Okay.
And I almost hate to put this on a recording because I think it's going to be confusing for a lot of people.
Okay.
Is there any way you would
be
willing to...
Hey, Rick, you might be able to pause the recording.
I don't know how to do that.
Oh.
Well, I was going to suggest maybe she call Leslie, or I can try to... I don't know if I can pause it. Can I pause it, Erin?
If you're logging up at the on the computer, look up at the top. I know you can stop it.
Yep, there's no
pause.
I'm
not completely certain you can start it again. Oh.
Okay, let me keep it going. I'll skip this question and save some time at the very end so I can end the call, okay?
Okay.
I think that might work.
That'll work, Rick.
Okay.
Because you can end the recording and continue the call.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Okay, Mary. Are you here, Mary? Well, Mary can listen later. My husband of 20 years has had a two-year affair with an out-of-town colleague on business trips. You know, we call that a geographic bachelor, and they travel and it's kind of like, well, anyway. Prior to the affair, we had a deficit-filled marriage. About a year into the affair, my husband decided it wasn't real and he was going nowhere and attempted to unsuccessfully end it. The affair partner threatened suicide, etc., and my husband couldn't turn his back. He's had no contact with her since the discovery about a year ago. 9 months prior to discovery, my husband sought out a counselor to help him figure out how to renew his relationship with me and how to end the affair. We've been in counseling since, 1.75 years, and are doing well. My husband has done everything I've asked him to restore trust. About 4 months prior to discovery, my husband decided he wanted to train for triathlon with several women. He knew I wouldn't like it, so he kept it secret. He met them for bike rides and conversed via cell phones and email. I found out about this after discovery when I was checking his emails. He said it was completely different than the affair. I say it was the same behavior. It just didn't involve sex. He says he's learning from all this what is acceptable. My question to you is it possible he really is this thick? I'm sorry. What do you think? Because of the two-year length of the affair, he got used to hiding things from me that I wouldn't like, and this was merely an innocent extension of that. It is unsettling to me that he's never engaged in this type of circuitous behavior before, and I need to know that it's not going to be a part of his new persona. Thank you for your input. Now, I remember this one. I actually got was when I was reading through all the questions for the webinar the other night. I saw this one. You know, without actually talking to him, I don't know what the answer is. I do know that he needs – the problem to me, first off, is as I look at this type of situation, isn't the fact even about the triathlon. The problem is that he's keeping secrets. And the way we define infidelity is it's the keeping of secrets. And I don't care what's happening with the other women that, you know, to the if intimacy is the ability to be naked and not ashamed, that that's a willingness to be known and let another person into your life, then the fact that he's hiding something that he knows you would want to know is the root of the problem. Now, I'm not saying whether or not the other women are an issue or not. I mean, certainly think that's putting himself in a very high-risk situation. But the bigger risk to me is just the fact that he's keeping secrets. And I think if you can't get somehow an agreement between the two of you of, you know, what is monogamy? And, you know, because y'all can address the issue of a triathlon if you can talk about it. But if he's going to unilaterally do whatever he wants to do and keep it a secret and at the same time rob you of your ability to make decisions or control and manipulate you by the flow of information, thereby robbing you of your ability to make a decision, that's not cool. And I'm glad that you've got a better marriage now. And I would say that there's probably a lot of hope. But really, the behavior that he's kind of picked up, you know, he's arguing because he's not doing anything with these women that there's nothing wrong, that they're just friends. Charlie Glass would say anytime you have to put just in front of the word friends, there's a problem anyway. I think his resource, and now that I say that, Mary, I'd certainly have him read Not Just Friends by Shirley Glass. I think that that would be a great help for him. Maybe at some point, kind of shifting his viewpoint about secretiveness and honesty. I don't know if it would be helpful, I was thinking resources, Private Lies by Frank Pittman, if it's still in print. The 911 marriage course, if, you know, just in terms of getting other men around him that are working at honesty and just saying that it's the honesty that's the issue. Because, you know, if someone does something with good intention, that doesn't mean they won't end up doing the wrong thing. I say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and just because he has good intentions and he's not doing anything wrong, if you put yourself in enough really stupid and bad situations, I can promise you something bad ultimately will happen. So with that diatribe that I just bit off there, does anybody have any comments about that or other things they would want to add? Y'all are really quiet today. That's okay. Okay. Let's see here. That made sense, correct?
Yes. I've read the book, Not Just Friends.
Yes. Okay. Hi, Rick. We need some more of the unfaithful guys asking questions. They ask good questions, too. I was hoping you could explain and give some understanding to how, after the discovery of your spouse's affair or affairs, it can change how you feel even towards your children. I'm a band coordinator for my state as well as a mentor for ARC. And I have forums and blogs all over the internet. And one question I get from mothers who do not understand how their feelings for their children can change. Although they love their children, they just do not or cannot do for their children like they did prior to discovery. I've tried myself to explain to them that it's temporary and that through their pain, it's hard to feel love or give love, but it's through healing, it all come back. Rick, this is something that is very hard for the mothers of in a marriage of betrayal to understand. I'm not sure if you've been asked this question before, but this is a very real and painful issue to deal with as a mother. Could you explain why this happens the effect it has on children and how to deal with their anger. When you're angry, how to deal with your children and help them with their pain while you're going through so much yourself. Hope you can understand what I'm asking. I'm writing this fast so you'll have it for your local call today. God bless. Okay. There's a book by Peter Rutter, and I'm not recommending y'all read it, but it's an interesting book anyway. It's called Sex in the Forbidden Zone. And Sex in the Forbidden Zone actually has a very interesting point that he makes. And it's actually a book for therapists and pastors and doctors and attorneys who actually have sex with clients. And it's part of his research around what that does to clients when you do that. And one of the pieces, and that's why it's not really relevant to you guys on the call, hopefully not, but one of the pieces that Peter comes up with is that a betrayal, at least for the women in his research, none of those women who went through that betrayal of trust of having an authority figure take advantage of them, none of those women had actually ever had a child after that point. It literally caused them to stop having children. And it was Peter's hypothesis that this was due to the fact that a betrayal of trust, of the person that you look to ultimately for life, really destroys hope, so that there's an astounding hopelessness that begins to be created. And that loss of hope, I mean, they can't even conceive of bringing children into the world. Now, I start with that to say, when you go through a betrayal, there is such a profound wound for your children as a parent, either husband or wife. You are their primary attachment figure. If you look at attachment theory, Bowlby's work, it would say that you are their primary attachment. But we also, as adults, our need for attachments, well, let me explain attachment a little bit. If you walk out of the room, all of us know, like with a two-year-old, what's going to ultimately happen is that two-year-old is going to go pitch and fit, right? And when you come back in the room, the two-year-old is going to be fine, because at one level, you know, what that child needs to know is that you're there, that they matter to you, that you care, that you're responsible. But they need your presence just to feel complete and to be okay. And we also know that in situations where children don't have that attachment, that ultimately they begin to develop all kinds of distress and can actually even develop a failure to thrive. They used to think back in the 1950s that, or even before then, that there was something wrong that we actually had that need for attachment. I remember I had my tonsils out, and my parents were only allowed to visit like one time a day for an hour. And this was a long time ago. Nowadays, if a parent only came up once a day or didn't come up, you know, we call CPS on them. In the 1960s, Bowlby's work came out, and he began to say that that was wrong, that actually children needed a strong attachment, that attachment was critical. It was so radical that he actually got into trouble with the AMA because they thought he had falsified his research. Of course, later, you know, it was actually substantiated, and it totally changed the way healthcare worked in terms of parents being with kids and surgery and all of that. But in the 70s, after that, then we came to the conclusion that, okay, that's fine for kids, but as adults, we should outgrow that. And that happens as we begin to differentiate and leave home at age 18, and we go on into adulthood. And now we no longer have that need for that primary attachment. Well, in the 90s, then more research began to show that the need for that attachment was every bit as present for adults as it is for children. It's just as important. So one of the things that happens whenever there's a betrayal is that what's created is what we call an attachment distress or an attachment trauma or an attachment injury. Now, that attachment injury, it's not just a matter, I mean, this is my theory, for whatever it's worth, that attachment injury doesn't just impact my relationship or your relationship with your mate. It actually, I think, damages to some extent that attachment mechanism, that there's a part of us that, you know, we just kind of, like a turtle drawn into a shell somewhat, just because of the nature of that injury, that it's very difficult for us to be out there because of that, the seriousness of that wound. I think that that adult attachment distress that occurred, that trauma that occurred, impacts also your ability to come back and attach in a normal way with your kids. That I think it's just reflexive that, you know, we shut down to such an extent and go so numb in terms of being able to attach that we're not even capable of attaching with our children the way that we once did. And until that trauma begins to heal and we move beyond it, I've worked with a lot of people that find it very difficult to even connect with their kids. I've had moms, you know, even tell me things like, you know, they were surprised that their kids could survive on vanilla wafers as long as they had, you know. They thought that you would die at that length, you know. Gosh, you know, you can live on vanilla wafers for 2 months or whatever. But it does impact that ability. And then it also creates another difficulty, I think, as a mom or a dad, where there's that huge attachment trauma, that attachment injury. When you begin to heal, there's a tendency, if you've got older children, or maybe not even so much older, then to look to the kids to begin to fill the void created by the other person. So there's a, and then that's a whole nother issue that's not even in this question. So I would just say that if you're having trouble connecting with your kids after a betrayal, that's very, very, very normal and certainly not something to be ashamed of. Healing from that is an issue of time. And at the ARC, we say, and this is one of the reasons I say that it takes 18 to 24 months. How you heal that internal trauma and how long it takes for the trauma to get better. And it's not that it doesn't get better, you know, it's bad for 18 to 24 months. However, there are going to be moments that it's difficult to come back out and for that attachment mechanism, that dynamic to work right for us to be emotionally connected again with other people, even our children. And but if you do your work, you do your grieving, you pass through the pain, you get your mind around it, you heal, you're patient with you, ultimately you really can heal and reconnect with your kids again. Now, the other question here, the effect it has on the children, you know, I guess the effect it has on children, I guess in my view, I know this is horrible, but oftentimes we think that, you know, we need to give, and I'm not saying it's okay for kids to go through hard things, but the things that ultimately taught me the greatest lessons were some of the hardest things I went through in life. And I really believe that, at least from a spiritual perspective, my God is big enough that regardless of what effect it has, he'll take care of that. The immediate effect, saying that in the long run it's going to be okay, Lord willing, as long as I continue to try to grow in my own healing, that they're going to also heal. If I'm not able to come back and you know, I become so focused on my mate that I lose, in my own wound, that I lose sight of them completely, that can be pretty devastating to kids. And they can end up being pretty bitter in the future. So healing for you, I think, is incredibly important just so it doesn't have that long-term effect on the children.
Rick, say that last thing you just said again. I didn't understand.
Okay, so if you in...
you said lose sight of something.
If you lose sight, let's say that you're keeping your focus on your mate and trying to... I mean, if all of your focus is kind of staying with, not healing, but just kind of staying in the bitterness and the resentment, and then what happens is it's like you never get to really come back to the kids again. And I do think that it's terribly important that you do your own healing if you're a parent so that you can still be there. You've got a responsibility to the kids. Even though this is a natural thing that happens, you need to get whole, I think, in the long run for their sake. And that's going to take a while. But the kids, just like you can heal, the kids will heal. And if the two of you work things out, obviously there's even some – and if you don't, I mean, there's still a lot of lessons to be learned. And we could get into a whole thing of how you handle kids, so I don't even want to go all the way into that. How to deal with their anger, the kid's anger, when you're angry at your spouse at times, it can be taken out on your children, only adding to the pain of the parent. You know, anger, I think that when people get so, when they're really in the rage mode, they really ought to wear a heart rate monitor. And they just need to quit talking to the kids when their pulse rate's over 100 because they're not going to be able to be rational with their kids, and they put their kids at risk. And you've got to take responsibility of not letting your anger come out on your kids. How do you deal with your children and help them with their pain while you're going through so much yourself? You know, sometimes I think you need to pull other people in. Sometimes I think therapists are really helpful there. Letting them talk and just listening and assuring them that you're there, that you're not going anywhere, that, you know, I mean, literally just being a parent for them, providing a safe place and letting them know you're going to try to be stable to the best of your ability. I mean, you still got to do that even though you don't maybe feel like it. So, Kathy? I don't know, whoever wrote the question, are you here?
Rick, that's Kathy of Kathy and Wayne.
That is Kathy?
Yeah, I don't think she's on the call, but that's that Kathy.
Okay, I was wondering if it might be, okay.
Yeah, but she, it doesn't look like she's on the line.
Okay.
Hey Rick,
well,
can I back you up?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to ask if there, back in the first answer you were giving about, you know, how it's hard to, you know, form emotional bonds when you're hurt. Can it be the extreme opposite? Because I know that once I discovered this, I gathered my kids to me, and now I'm not afraid to let them go, but I'm much more careful about letting them out of my sight right now. And I'm wondering if that's because I need to form some sort of emotional attachment.
That, okay, Matt, you're say that one more time, please.
Okay. You know how Kathy was saying in her letter that some of the mothers were having a hard time, you know, being attached to their children. I found that I did the exact extreme opposite of that. I gathered my children closer to me, and I keep tighter controls on them now. And you know, maybe to the point that it could be overbearing, I don't know. But you know, I formed a much deeper relationship with my kids, but they still, you know, miss their mother a great deal.
Right. And the problem that what Kathy's writing about is someone who's dealing with a lot of anger.
Right. And I am that.
You know, people just have different ways of coping, and but you're right. Either one, you don't want to smother and basically. That was that comment I made where I said, you know, you can also look to your kids to end up replacing part of what you're missing with your mate.
And that's probably what I'm doing.
And you don't want to do that. That's actually called spousification. And it's not that you're treating them like a spouse, but if you begin to use them for comfort, it puts they sense that unconsciously, I think, and it puts a lot of pressure on them. So they need to know that they don't have to be there for you to be okay. Otherwise, what happens is they begin to feel guilty about their own separation and doing things and having fun because they don't want to leave you alone because you're so wounded and so hurt. So you need to be able to show them, you know, that you've got other resources that you look to and that they're kind of free and encouraged to go live their life and to follow whatever God has for them.
Right. All right, well, thank you.
Rick, I have a question.
Okay.
This is Cheryl. What about, because this is all so new, just being a couple of weeks out from him leaving, they don't want to talk to him or call him, or and he, of course, hasn't tried to because he doesn't want to answer any of their questions or deal with what he calls judgment by them. So is it okay for them just to kind of take their time and not feel like they should try to be calling him or something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, part of it, you know, hopefully he's making overtures to them. He's
no,
the parent.
He's not making any overtures.
If they want to try to, yeah, if they want to try to talk to him, certainly they are free to call him, but in the long run, Cheryl, I mean, the message he's giving them by not trying to pursue them, even if he's having problems with you, he doesn't need to be communicating to them that they're not important. And that to me
is,
yeah, that's the tragedy of what he's doing is that right now he's saying, you know, all that's important to me, you know, is this relationship, and you don't matter. At least that's what it sounds like, and that's tragic and very sad. Hopefully, he'll wake up. But, you know, I've known people where this has happened and where they've just kind of left the family, period. I mean, it's like abandonment. They just go and live another life, and that's it, and they never have a relationship with the kids. My grandfather actually did this. To my mom. And ultimately the family, the way they adapted to it, I'm not sure it's the way I would recommend, but they all just kind of pretended that he didn't exist. I mean, the only way I ever got any information about, they never talked about him. It was like he was gone. And ultimately the only way I ever got information about Granddad was through one of my great uncles. So, you know, I think that you don't have to live in denial like my mom's family did. But at the same time, the kids need to be able to grieve, and we need to be able to also talk about what happened to Dad. That's going to be an issue to be discussed farther down the line. You know, it's just a crazy situation.